Welcome to Convention Pulpit, Wesleyan Voices Past and Present, brought to you through the Ministry of Inner Church Holiness Convention, www.ihconvention.com.
The sermon you're going to hear on today's podcast is a searching one by Paul Kaufman. He simply titles it, "What is Your Price?" I know you will enjoy this excellent sermon.
Thank you for that beautiful old song. I want to speak to you this evening about someone who met the Master, but not under the best of circumstances. And you'll understand as we move along. If you have your Bibles, open them, please, to the book of Numbers, chapter 22. The book of Numbers, chapter 22. While you're turning to that, let me give you a little advice on how to handle your conversation. I found this helpful. Someone said this about three different groups of people in their conversation. Said, great minds discuss ideas. Great minds discuss ideas. Average minds discuss events. And small minds discuss people. I'll do that again for you. Great minds discuss ideas, concepts. Average minds discuss events. Small minds discuss people. Just a little something to think about the next time you get involved in a good conversation. I'm not preaching on gossip this evening. I want to talk to you about a fellow who has intrigued me for a long time. He's caught the attention of at least three New Testament writers. I'm referring to this fellow by the name of Balaam. I want to talk to you this evening about Balaam. Peter has some things to say about Balaam. Jude, in his little epistle, speaks about Balaam. And John the Revelator, in his words to one of the seven churches of Asia Minor, refers to Balaam. None of them have anything complimentary to say about this prophet of God. What kind of a prophet was he? You won't find him in the great faith chapter that our brother spoke of the other day. Hebrews chapter 11 overlooks him. He's a man who had a lot of potential, but he had issues in his life that got the supremacy, and he went down to failure. I think there are some lessons we can pick up from his life. So let me just read you a few verses. Actually, to cover his entire story, I'd have to read you Numbers 22, 23, and 24. And I'm not going to do that this evening. But for the sake of a little context, let's look in Numbers chapter 22. I also want you to find the book of Ezekiel. And I want you to find chapter 21 and put a marker in there so that when I need it, it won't take you 5 minutes to find it. Ezekiel 21. We'll mention something out of that as well. Let me say the setting for this account of Balaam takes place outside the borders of Israel, and none of the main players are even Jews. These are all Gentiles that I'll be speaking to you about, even though one of them is a prophet. The children of Israel have left Egypt. They've been wandering around for almost 40 years in the wilderness, and now they're closing in on the borders of Canaan and about to cross Jordan. And as they're pitched on the plains of Moab, we'll pick up the account here. Let's start with verse 2, Numbers 22:2. And Balak, this is the king of the Moabites, saw that all that Israel had done to the Amorites. Verse 3, and Moab was sore afraid of the people because they were many, and Moab was distressed because of the children of Israel. And Moab said unto the elders of Midian, now he goes to a group near him, and he says, now shall this company lick up all that are round about us as the ox licketh up the grass of the field? And Balak the son of Zippor was king of the Moabites at that time. Now notice his plan, how he's going to deal with this perceived threat of the Israelites. He sent messengers therefore unto Balaam, the son of Beor, to Pethor, which is by the river. Now, in the Old Testament, and when you read about something taking place at the river, if the river is not identified, it's almost always the Euphrates River, which in this case is quite a few hundred miles from where he's located. He sent these messengers to Balaam up by the river Euphrates, and he said to call to him, "Behold, there is a people come out from Egypt. Behold, they cover the face of the earth." Well, not quite, but to him, that's what he looked like was happening. And he said, "And they abide over against me. They're encamped near my borders. Come now," he said, "therefore," and look at his request. He said, "I pray thee, curse me, this people, for they are too mighty for me. Peradventure I shall prevail, that we may smite them, and that I may drive them out of the land. For I wot, that is, I know, that he whom thou blessest is blessed, and he whom thou cursest is cursed." And let me stop there for a little while and say a few things about Balaam. The question comes up, how should we interpret this fellow Balaam? Is he a prophet? Is he a good man? Is he a scoundrel? What is he? We know that he lived in the East, as did Abraham and Laban and Job and the wise men. A lot of interesting people come from the East. Some see him as a heathen sorcerer who set on bringing about the ruin of Israel. Others, scholars, have seen him in a more lofty position as a true prophet born out of time, almost like a Melchizedek who just sort of appears on the scene and then we hear no more about him. Truth of the matter is, he's probably more like Samson. Everybody knows the story of Samson, someone who was used of God as a tool in God's hands. In general, of course, he does not pass the test of biblical morality. He does seem to have limited light. He has some abilities as a prophet, but clearly he's looking out for his own interests, what Jesus would call a hireling, and he'll do seemingly whatever it takes for money. Jude, in his book, speaks of the greed of Baal. Isn't that something? Hundreds and hundreds of years later, this man is still known as a man who was tied to his money. The typical hireling prophet seeking only to make the most of his gift. In that setting, we would say he was probably an occultist, what were known as a diviner or a soothsayer. Sometimes these fellows were called augurs or just plain seers. Let me show you how they work. Now, I asked you to look at the book of Ezekiel, chapter 21. I'm going to read you a strange sounding verse. You're going to say, "What in the world does that have to do with anything?" Well, it has everything to do with people like Balaam. Ezekiel, chapter 21, talks about the king of Babylon marching toward Jerusalem. And in verse 21, now I'm in Ezekiel 21, 21. It's a strange verse. Let me explain it to you. "For the king of Babylon stood at the parting of the way at the head of two ways to use divination." Divination. He needs an answer to something. And then Ezekiel says, "He made his arrows bright. He consulted with images. He looked in the liver." These soothsayers, these augurs, these seers had strange ways of trying to divine the future. Now, when I pastored in Hagerstown, Maryland, out in the business section, with all these buildings all around, commercial buildings, here was this house where a certain madam lived who could foretell the future, had a big billboard out in her front yard. For X amount of money, you could go in and she'd read the tea leaves or read your palm or something. People want to know, what does the future hold? They're sometimes called augurs. Sometimes they would catch a bird, a certain species of birds, cut it open, find their liver, split open the liver, and study that. I remember in an archaeology class, we read about some of the strange ways these people try to discern the future. Do you remember that occasion when one of the prophets was about to talk about the battle between Israel and Syria, and he said, "Take your arrows and strike the ground." You remember? And he was supposed to strike the ground so many times. That was a method of divination, this thing of looking in livers or watching the flight pattern of birds. These people would get the ideas of what the gods were telling them. That word augur has surfaced in our culture as the name of a speech that the president gives after he takes the oath of office. It's called the inaugural address. That word augur is in there. He's going to foretell the future for the next 4 years for the country. It's an old word. And sometimes these people use strange ways to try to predict the future. Well, this Balaam was one of these seers, but he had abilities that were known far and wide. When Balak sent for him, he said, "I perceive whom thou cursest is cursed, and whom thou blessest is blessed. You've got skills that we've heard of hundreds of miles away, and you come on down here and we can use you." And so the offer is made to Balaam. Let me read a little bit about the offer that they make to him. Verse 7, back in Numbers 22. "And the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the rewards of divination in their hand, and they came to Balaam, and they spoke unto him the words of Balak. Well, he said unto them, 'Lodge ye here this night, and I will bring you word again, as the Lord shall speak unto me.' And the princes of Moab abode with Balaam." Now God comes to him that night. Notice verse 9. "And God came unto Balaam and said," and notice he doesn't say, "Who are these men with you?" He said, "What are these men with you?" I can almost hear the sarcasm in God's voice, like, "What gives, Balaam? What in the world are you even entertaining here? These people are wanting you to come and curse my people. Balaam, haven't you ever heard of Genesis 12:3 that says, 'Those that bless you, I will bless, and those that curse you, I will curse.' And these guys have come with money to hire you to curse my people, Israel. What gives?" You know, there are some things, people, you don't even have to pray about. Do you know that? There are just some things that are just so obvious, it doesn't even require us to involve God with it. Now, you and I will always be subject to temptation. I hate to inform you tonight, there's no work of grace that's going to take you beyond the realm of temptation. Satan, that fellow who walks about as a roaring lion, always on the job, is going to come with a temptation. I remember not too long ago, I was in the JCPenney store. My wife, like most women, likes to shop. She doesn't buy a whole lot, but she just likes to shop. Brother Cates, I've never figured out what women get out of just shopping. It just seems to satisfy some innate desire they have. She'll come out with a big smile on her face, hasn't bought a thing, but she just really feels relieved because she's been shopping. So I turned her loose one night in Penney's, and I was wandering around and ended up on the shoe department. And there my eyes were drawn to a pair of Florsheim dress shoes. Retail price was $99, and I saw the price was $49. And I looked at those, and I thought, now that might be a good deal. If I know my Beth, that's about half price. That's a good pair of shoes to get for half price. And then I noticed there was another sign beside him that said $79. So the clerk came over and said, "May I help you?" I said, "Yeah, I'm curious." I said, "Are these shoes $49 or are they $79? "Oh," she said, "I'm sorry." She said, "They didn't get that sign changed." She said, "Really, they're $79. And then here's what she said. She said, "Since you saw the $49 sign there," she said, "I'll honor that." And I could sense the hesitancy, but after all, it did say $49. And she said, "And you can have them for $49. And I said, "Ma'am," I said, "if the real price is $79 and I bought them for $49, I said, "I'd feel guilty every time I put them on. Thanks, I'll just pass on them." I knew those shoes weren't supposed to be $49, and because of human error, I couldn't enjoy a good deal like that if I had to do it at somebody else's expense. Now, you may look at me and say, "Boy, he's not too smart after all." But you know, you'll always be confronted with temptations, and in your heart of hearts, you know what you ought to do. And here comes these fellows to Balaam. Now, he should have run those men off right away. The minute he heard what they were up to, he should have said, "Man, I'm not interested. Shame on you for even coming my way. Go back and tell your leader I'm not interested." But you know what? He didn't do that. He hung around that area of temptation that I talked about the other night. And you mess around with temptation long enough, and sooner or later, it'll get you. I think of Joseph. What a noble example. When Potiphar's wife, that good-looking woman with all that money at her disposal, threw herself at that young man, a normal red-blooded man with natural functioning hormones, and she's throwing herself, and he finally just left his coat behind and ran out of the house. Sometimes you just got to pack up and run. You hang around. And let me tell you something else. You need to make up your mind ahead of time what you're going to do when temptation does come. Because once you're in the throes of passion, and once you've already entered into the temptation, that's a tough time then to try to decide what's right and wrong. You need to purpose in your heart of heart ahead of time that if the situation comes, I'm going to do the right thing. That's the safest way. I don't think there's ever a question in Balaam's mind what God's will is. I've been talking to you about walking in the light. He knows what God's word says about cursing his people. He's got a conscience that I'm sure told him that's dangerous business to mess around with these people. And so God tells him what he's supposed to do. Nothing. Now let me tell you something. Temptation that is rejected half-heartedly is presented again and again with greater force. You need to be very clear to Satan when you say no to him. You say, well, I don't think I will. Man, you've left the door open for another round. He'll just keep the pressure on. And so he sort of sends them away, but he's almost left the door open for something else to happen. Sure enough, these men go back to Balak. And they tell him, well, the answer is no. Oh, he said, I've got to have his services. And so let's see what happens now. He gets up in verse 13. Balaam rose up in the morning, said unto the princes, get you to your land, for the Lord refuseth to give me leave to go with you. I can almost hear the whining in his voice. I'd really like to accommodate you fellows, but God says I can't do it. Kind of blames it on God. And so they went back. Now watch verse 15. Here comes the second offer. And Balak sent yet again princes, more and more honorable than they. He moves up the chain of command in his realm. He gets some higher ranking princes and apparently loads them up with more money. And they came to Balaam and said unto him, thus saith Balak the son of Zippor, let nothing, I pray thee, hinder thee from coming unto me. And he said, for I will promote thee unto very great honor, and I will do whatsoever thou sayest unto me. Come therefore, I pray thee, curse me, this people. Now watch what Balaam does. He answered and said unto the servants of Balak, if Balak would give me his house full of silver, I cannot go beyond the word of the Lord to do less or more. But notice, instead of sending them away, he says, now therefore, I pray you, tarry ye here also this night, that I may know what the Lord will say unto me more. He said, I'm going to go back to the Lord in prayer, and I'm going to see if I can talk him into changing his mind. You know, you can push God and push God until God will finally give you what you want. I read in the book of Psalms where it says, they pressed God, and finally it says, and God granted them their request, but he sent leanness to their soul. Apparently, you can push God until he'll give you what you really want to do. You have a conscience, you know what's right or wrong. Why in the world are you even bothering God? I heard about a boy who came up on his conscience for the very first time. Theodore Parker was a minister in Boston. He tells the story when he was a lad of only 4 years of age that he goes for a walk with his father to a field some distance from the house. After a while, his father sent him back to the house, and he passes a little pond on the way. He stops to notice some rare flowers growing there, and while he stops, he notices a little turtle sitting on a branch over here by this pond, sunning himself in the sun. Parker said later, he said, I lifted my stick to kill it. He had seen other bigger boys kill turtles and things like that. But he said all at once something checked me. A voice said, "It is wrong." He said, I held up the stick in wonder of the new emotion that I felt. And soon I went home and I asked Mother. Mother, he said, what was it that told me it was wrong? She wiped a tear from her eye, took young Parker in her arms and said, son, some men call it conscience, but I prefer to call it the voice of God. If you listen and obey it, it will speak clearer and clearer and always guide you right. But if you turn a deaf ear and disobey, it will fade out little by little and leave you in the dark with no guide at all. Learn to say no. Don't entertain temptation. Two boys were walking along, little older boys. One of them had a bottle of drink. He takes this bottle from his pocket and turns to his friend and says, have some? Well, the boy said, hand it over. The bottle was passed over. The recipient lifted the bottle as high as he could and smashed it on the ground. Said to his friend, don't ever put a bottle to my lips again. His no didn't have any yes in it. He didn't leave the door wide open for another round. Young people, when you know it's wrong, deal with it so there's no doubt in anybody's mind how you feel about it, and they'll leave you alone. You can save yourself a lot of problems. Balaam says, I'll ask the Lord, see if he'll maybe change his mind. A man and a woman were out on the dance floor one night. It was getting later and later. Finally, he looked at his companion and said to her, would you spend the night with me for $10,000? She pulled back, thought about it, and said, well, all right. They danced on, and he said, would you spend the night with me for $1,000? She thought a little more and said, well, all right. And then he said, will you spend the night with me for $20? She reared back in a huff and said, what do you think I am? He said, my dear, we've already established what you are. We're merely working out the price. What is your price, friend? What are you willing to sell out for? We'll see what Balaam sells for. A riverboat captain on the Ohio River, somewhere up around Pittsburgh, was approached by a man, came on board his old paddle wheeler, said, I have some expensive cargo I want you to haul to New Orleans for me. And it was clear to him that this was illegal contraband of some kind. He said, I'll give you $10,000 if you'll haul this stuff to New Orleans for me. This was back in the paddle boat days. Captain says, can't do it. He hauled around a little bit and he offered him $12,000. No, I said, I can't do it. Well, he said, I'll give you $15,000. And the captain said, get off my boat. He said, you're getting too near my price. Satan knows how to keep the pressure on. And unless you've decided ahead of time how you're going to deal with right and wrong, you might find yourself vacillating and get yourself into sort of a weak no answer where Satan can keep the pressure on. Balaam says, I'll talk to God. Stay with me tonight. I'll see what the Lord is adding to say to me. Now notice what happens. It says in verse 20, and God came to Balaam at night and said unto him, if the men come to call thee, rise up and go with them. But yet the word which I shall say unto thee, that shalt thou do. And Balaam rose up in the morning and saddled his ass and went with the princes of Moab. Now God has told him the first time, you cannot go. And he said, God won't let me go. He clearly understood. But the offer comes again. Apparently they sensed the way he said no, there might be some hope. And so just like the devil does, they up the ante. And finally God says, Balaam, if you really think I want you to go, then you can go. Now, I cast about in my own life for an illustration to try to tell you what I think is going on here. And it took me in my mind back When I was finishing up my days at the old Salem Bible College, my brother had bought an airless paint sprayer, and we were doing a lot of spray painting. I hired one of my classmates, and he and I would go out and we'd spray paint apartment houses. We made some good money. We got into some sixplexes and some fourplexes. We could go out in the afternoon and make $600-$800 in one afternoon. It was good money. One morning after early morning prayer meeting, my old pastor, who lived in an old house out in Damascus, Ohio, he caught me in the vestibule. "Paul," he said, "I want you to come out and look at my house. I want you to give me a price on painting it." Now, I really wasn't in the painting business as far as painting old houses with a lot of trim on them. I was more in the new construction. That's where the money was. But this is my pastor asking me. I said, "Okay, I'll come out and look at it." So one evening on the way home from work, we stopped in his old house in Damascus. Man, it had all kind of trim on it. He had wooden floors on the porch and wooden ceilings on the porch and all kinds of weird-looking fascia. I could see a disaster in the making, but it was my pastor. So I gave him a price, and I said, "We'll do it." So we got out, and we started painting. And we were almost finished. Now, what makes this story a little more real for me is I knew one thing about my pastor. He despised the color red. He grew up back in the 20s and 30s when I guess red had a certain connotation that by the time I was in my late teens, early 20s, I just didn't think about red. What he thought about red reminded him, I guess, of the red light district or something. I don't know. Red just had a negative connotation. And every once in a while, he'd even mention the color red in his sermon. So I knew how he felt about red. So we were almost done painting the house. In fact, we were almost finished. And I called him out in the backyard one night. I said, "Brother McPherson," I said, "out in the back, you got this old cast iron coal door. Some of you know what a coal door is. That old cast iron door they'd prop open and put that ramp down in there, and they could shovel coal down into the coal cellar. Maybe you have to live up north to know what a coal door is anyhow. This thing was semi-rusted." And I said to him, I said, "I've got some Rust-Oleum red, I think it was, some kind of red enamel. I said, I'll wire brush that thing off and paint that door red for you. I just happen to have some red paint in the car." Man, he looked at me like I just kicked at him. He said, "If you think I want that door painted red," he said, "then you paint it red." Man, his voice was heavy with irony. I knew he didn't mean what he was saying. He said, "If you think I want it red, then you paint it red." So acting like I didn't know for sure what he meant, I said, "Well, okay," and we went on home. Next morning, went to prayer meeting. Prayer meeting was over. I had this can of red paint in the trunk of my old car. We went out there, and I told my helper what we were going to do. He wire brushed the door, and I got that can of red enamel, fire engine red, and I hosed that thing down real well. And then I went around to have him come out and inspect the job. That was the last thing. The job was done at that point. I saved the best for last. He lived in one of those old houses where you had an upstairs, and then the cellar steps went halfway down to a landing, and then there was a side door, and then the stairs went the rest of the way to the basement. And that dear little Anna Talbot McPherson I mentioned to you the other night, who's written all those books, she was going down the stairways with a basket of clothes in her hands, and I tapped on that window on that side door, and she stopped and put down the clothes basket and opened the door and greeted me. "Good morning, Paul. How are you?" "Fine." "Sister McPherson, I'm not sure. He said to me if I thought he wanted that door red, go ahead and paint it red. So I did. I hope it's okay." She let out a little gasp like she'd just seen a rattlesnake, turned around and galloped up those steps into the kitchen. I heard her running through the dining room. I heard her running through the living room. And she reached the foot of those stairs, and he's upstairs shaving. He's got shaving cream all over his face, and she yells. I could hear this through the wall. She tells him what happened. He slides up the sash in the bedroom window or the bathroom window and leans out with shaving cream all over his face. "Paul," he said, "what have you done to my house?" He comes back down, wipes all this lather off, comes out in the backyard, and he just blanched. I had desecrated his house with that red door. And he turned and looked at me, and he said, "Son," he said, "there's no way a fellow's going to collect $1 on this job until that door is another color." So I let it dry, and I had some black paint, and all was well after that. He forgot the matter. But I've often thought, he said, "if I thought he wanted that door red, go ahead and do it." And when I think of that, I think of God and Balaam. God says to Balaam, "Balaam, if you really think I want you to go, then you go ahead and go." Balaam should have recognized he's going from thin ice to no ice, and watch what happens. The next morning, he gets up. Verse 21, he rose up in the morning. Something tells me he got up awful early. I think he's in an awfully good mood. I think he's awfully excited. And he's telling his people, whoopee, he says, God said I can go. Man, let's go. Saddle up. Let's hit the trail, fellas. God's in his heaven and all's well on earth. He said I can go. And he's all excited, heading off to curse God's people. Here's the fellow who said earlier, if Balak would give me half my house, I wouldn't touch this thing with a 10-foot pole. But he has so rationalized his way around, now it's okay. He's given himself permission, and somehow he's talked God into saying he could go. God has granted his request, but we'll see. He sends leanness to his soul. Jude speaks of Balaam's deceit over in the New Testament. Let me tell you, friend, nobody likes to be deceived. Nobody likes it when somebody has deceived them. But the worst kind of deceit at all is when you deceive yourself. It's fatal. Self-deception. I was talking to someone, I think just earlier today. The difference between apostasy and backsliding. I'm sure we could argue this up and argue it down. But basically, to me, the way I see it, and you don't have to agree with me, the way I see it, a backslider knows he's out of victory. He probably can tell you where he got out of victory, and he probably can tell you what he needs to do to get back into victory. But the apostate has no idea where he's at. He's living in a fog. He doesn't seem to know right from wrong morally anymore. He goes on acting like everything is fine, and he's as lost as though he were already in hell. I wouldn't want to be either one at all. But if I were in one or the other, I'd far rather be a backslider that at least had a sense of right and wrong and knew where I was. But this poor prophet of God has so talked himself into the wrong that he's actually happily going off to do what he wants to do, feeling that God somehow is even supporting what he's doing. It's amazing the things I hear people can talk themselves into doing, and they know it's wrong. My first church was a little pioneer church. It was a ghastly affair. If I were a sinner looking for a church, that'd be the last place I'd consider going. It was the oldest building in Hagerstown, Maryland, only two blocks from downtown. I think it was on the National Register. It was an ugly building. It wasn't air-conditioned in the summer. It wasn't hardly heated in the winter. No parking, no grass, didn't need a lawnmower, wasn't any grass. I told people I raised my daughters on a fire escape. That's not much of a playground. And this poor thing, this old hot sanctuary, had one bathroom in the place, behind a curtain, behind the pulpit. It took a lot of courage to go to the bathroom in that church. You had to get up and march forward and get around behind the curtain. And the old door to that bathroom didn't fit very well, and you could hear everything that happened in that bathroom once somebody got there. I mean, you could hear everything that happened. I've told my students I've had many a masterpiece sermon literally go down the drain. And in that poor little beginnings of a church, I had a man who had once been a pastor. Pastored four Allegheny churches. I've preached in churches where I saw the little plaque in the vestibule where they listed all the former pastors, and I saw his name listed there. On his fourth church, he started looking around. There was a young youth president, a young lady who led the singing. He was a man in his 40s. They said he'd sit on the platform while she was leading the song services, and he'd eye her up from the back. Got too friendly, got too familiar. When they were remodeling the parsonage, he would bring her over to get her opinion on things, and little by little, that situation got out of hand, and finally she became pregnant with his child. That man sat in my living room. I'm not telling you hearsay. I'm telling you right out of his mouth what he did. He said, I drove to Pittsburgh, found a psychiatrist that'd give me the right kind of medication. He said, I took it home, somehow talked to his wife into taking these pills, and it basically put her out. He said, I got her into the back seat of the car and drove her to Warren, Pennsylvania, and committed her to a state insane asylum, divorced her, and married the other woman. Now, years and years later, as an old man in his probably late 70s, early 80s, he's attending my church. He somehow rationalized in his mind it was okay. People who know adultery is wrong, they'll say, but we're really in love. This guy I've been living with, I've been married to for years, there's no love there, but we have this special relationship, this other lady and I. And somehow that makes it okay. I'm appalled at what I hear people can talk themselves in. Once you get started down that road, friend, I guess you can rationalize your way around anything. Of course, you'll face the consequences for that. Poor Balaam, he's deceived himself that everything's okay. But you know, look at verse 22, paragraph marker. Let's see how happy God is. Here's Balaam, he's bopping along, ka-ching, ka-ching. He can hear the cash register ringing already. Man, there's money to be made. All he's got to do is get down there and speak a few words, and he can come home a wealthy man. He can be promoted to great honor. No wonder the New Testament calls him greedy, calls him a hireling. Verse 22 says, and God's anger was kindled because he went. God's not happy at all. He lets him go, but immediately his anger comes to the surface. And the angel of the Lord stood in the way for an adversary against him. Now, Satan is called the Satan in Hebrew, is the adversary. You know, God can actually turn around and fight against you and become your adversary. That's a scary thought. I talk to these people and say, oh, God always loves me, you know. God always loves me. Just a little talk with Jesus makes it right. God always, listen, you can mess around and mess around with God, and monkey around, as one preacher said, until God will become your adversary, not your advocate. And this says, this is the angel of the Lord. You understand in the Old Testament, when the angel of the Lord is referred to, we're talking about the second person of the Trinity. We're talking about Jesus Christ in a pre-incarnate Old Testament appearance. That's why I made the comment I did when they sang, I met the Master. I told you there's another fellow tonight who met the Master. But look what this Master he's doing now when God's Son, Jesus Christ, appears as the angel of the Lord. He stood in the way for an adversary against him. Now the writer said he was riding upon his ass and his two servants were with him. And I assume he's riding in the company of all these emissaries that have come from Balak. There's probably quite a little cavalcade traveling along here, a caravan of some kind. And it says, and the Lord stood in the way. Now remember I told you when we started this, these people were called seers. They could see special things that nobody else can see. Now I want you to see how well the seer can see. You know what? He's blind as a proverbial bat. His donkey's got better vision than he does. And it says, the angel of the Lord stood in the way. Now as he's riding on his ass and his two servants with him. And the ass saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way. And not only that, this angel's got a sword in his hand. And the ass turned aside out of the way and went into the field. And Balaam smote the ass to turn her into the way. He gets his stick, beats on the donkey. Watch what happened. God moves down the way a little bit farther. But the angel of the Lord stood in the path in the vineyards, a wall beyond this side and a wall on that side. When the ass saw the angel of the Lord, she thrust herself unto the wall and crushed Balaam's foot against the wall. And he smote her again. All of a sudden, his world's getting a little touchy. And the angel of the Lord went further and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn either to the right hand or to the left. And when the ass saw the angel of the Lord, she fell down under Balaam. And Balaam's anger now, this towering rage, was kindled, and he smote the ass with a staff. Now watch what happens. And the Lord opened the mouth of the ass. This is amazing. This should give every preacher who thinks he can't preach a little bit of courage. God can talk through the mouth of a donkey. She opened the mouth of the ass and said unto Balaam, now, this is a conversation between a donkey and a human being. Notice what's going on here. And she says, what have I done unto thee that thou hast smitten me these three times? Well, he says, you've ridiculed me, you've provoked me, you've mocked me. And he said, I were there a sword in my hand, for now would I kill thee. Man, if he said, if I had a sword, you'd be dead. He's in a towering rage. And by the way, Do you believe that? I'll tell you what, we won't turn over to 2 Peter, but he does. In verse 16 of chapter 2, he says, "The dumb ass speaking with a man's voice forbade the madness of the prophet." That's what Peter said about it over in the New Testament. He believed the donkey talked. I know a lot of skeptics don't, but I happen to believe it. So now he says, "I'd kill you if I had the right thing in my hand. If I had a gun, I'd shoot you," or something like that. And the ass continues the conversation. This gets amazing. It says, "Am I not thine ass, upon which thou hast ridden ever since I was thine unto this day?" And this poor blinded prophet who can't even see God says to him, "No." And then it says, "And the Lord opened the eyes of Balaam, and he saw the angel of the Lord." God, in a moment of mercy, touches his blinded man's eyes, and he sees the sword in his hand, and he says he bowed down his head and fell flat on his face. And verse 32, "And the angel of the Lord said unto him, Wherefore hast thou smitten thine ass these three times? Behold, I went out to withstand thee, because thy way is perverse before me." You know better than to be doing this thing. What kind of a project have you gotten yourself into? And he said, "And the ass saw me and turned from thee these three times. Unless she had turned from me, surely now I had slain thee and saved her alive." Boy, he said, you ought to hug that donkey. That donkey saved your life. Makes me think of the cowboy and the prospector. Prospector and his old donkeys riding out across the hot desert sands of the West, a gold prospector. The cowboy is coming along behind, riding a horse, and he overtakes the old prospector. He decides to have a little fun at his expense. So he rides up beside the old boy, and he pulls out his six-shooter, and he says, "Get down off that mule." The old boy, scared to death, he jumps off. He says, "I'm going to learn you how to dance." And he starts shooting around the feet of the old prospector. Here he is in his hobnail boots, jumping up and down. Bullets are ricocheting all over the place, and that cowboy's just laughing his head off, firing away. And then he ran out of bullets. Now he stops to reload, and while he's reloading, that old prospector slides his hand across the saddle of the old mule, reaches down in that scabbard and slides out that Winchester 30-30, and he jacks one home. And he points that thing at that cowboy. He said, "Have you ever kissed a mule?" And that cowboy said, "No, but I've always wanted to." When I think of that story, I think of Balaam. He ought to have kissed that mule. The Lord said, "That mule saved your..." That mule's got more sense than you do, Balaam. "Your way is perverse before me." The Lord opened the eyes of the seer, uncovered it. He said, "I went out to withstand thee. Thy way is perverse before me." Well, then, Balaam says in verse 34, well, he said, "I have sinned." This is a real confession. "I have sinned, for I knew not that thou stoodest in the way against me." He's not even dealing with the issue. "I've sinned because I didn't recognize you." Listen, that's not the issue. It's amazing how many times people come to the altar and pray all the way around the barn and never do get down to the real issue. Was it old Uncle Buddy Robinson one time? A lady came down to the altar, prayed for a while, and she told him she didn't really know what her problem was. And with his lisping voice, he said, "Well then, sister, just take a guess." And sure enough, she hit it the first time she guessed. If you're out of victory with God, I wouldn't be surprised you could tell me exactly why you're out of victory. You don't have to come down here with a bunch of question marks. You know where you broke with God. We were home on the farm. The biggest worry a farmer has are the fences. Happy is the farmer who has good fences. We had over 100 head of sheep on our farm. I was amused when I listened to you preach the other day. I thought, I wish our sheep behaved like those ones you were talking about. My brother and I weren't good shepherds, though. We tried to drive the sheep. Doesn't work. They didn't know our voice. They heard our voice. They ran the other way. One of them gets out, they all get out. Many a night we'd come home from church. Time to milk the cow. We had a poor family cow. She got milked at any hour of the day. You talk about regularity. Whenever it suited, we'd milk her. My sisters get to go to bed, and my brother and I got a flashlight and go try to find a cow in a 20-acre pasture with hills and trees. We'd traipse all over that place, couldn't find her, but then we found the hole in the fence. And it's amazing, every time you find that cow, she had a guilty conscience. She knew she didn't belong over in that alfalfa field, first of all. And second of all, she knew exactly where to go to get back in. She knew where she'd gotten out. Some cows are smarter than people. You know exactly where you broke with God. And I tell you what, if you have a need, why don't you just deal exactly with that need? Don't come down here and say, Lord, I'll be a missionary to Indonesia, or I'll do this. That's not your problem. You know exactly where you rebelled. You know where you refused to walk in the light. So Balaam says, well, I've sinned because I didn't know you were standing in the way. It's like, forgive me for not recognizing you, God. I've sinned. Wasn't the issue at all. Now he says, therefore, if it displease thee, I will get me back again. He totally misses the point. But you know, I see something encouraging in this. No matter how badly you've messed up, God said, I'll tell you what, Balaam, you go ahead and go, and I'm going to still get something positive out of this situation. Satan will tell you, you've messed up so bad there's no hope for you. I'm here to give you a little encouragement tonight, friends. There isn't a corner big enough that Satan can get you into, but what God's got a way to get you out. No matter how bleak the situation is, the Son of God has always got a way of escape for you. Satan loves to tell you you've crossed the line. How many times do people come up and they want to know, well, what do you feel like when you cross the line of no return? You know, how do you know if you have? I'm amazed at how many people I meet who think they have. And I tell you, the very fact that you walked up to me and you have an interest in salvation is evidence to me you haven't crossed the line. No matter what Satan says to you, God has got a way out. And here's a hopeless-looking situation that God's going to get glory out of it. I'll just cut to the chase and tell you some of the most grand and glorious prophecies ever uttered in the Old Testament are going to come out of this boy's mouth in spite of himself, not because he's such a godly man. But you can keep pushing God, till he'll give you what you want. How many times have I been sitting in my office and some guy will come in? They want to know my response. They want to know what I'm thinking about the girl that they're interested in. I could run myself a little counseling service just for people interested in dating or getting married. And I used to be dumb enough to tell them what I thought. I get smart too late. I told you, my new motto is I never got in trouble for something I didn't say. Well, I've had fellows come in my office in the college and say, well, what do you think of her? I said, well, I really don't think she's for you. Well, why not? And I'd tell him. And he'd run out and tell her right away, and I had an enemy for life. So I don't tell him anymore. But I've seen precious young men who had a lot going for them, who could have been a real asset in the ministry. But there was a certain young lady they had to have. I'm thinking of a fellow right now, sang in the quartet, nice looking. My wife had known their families for years. Here came this little blonde-haired fluff check that came to Bible school for one reason, to find some handsome hunk and take him home with her. He came to my office many times. Boy, I said, what do you think? Well, I don't know. Is she going to be an asset to you in the ministry? Can you see her in the parsonage? Well, I don't know. And you could tell he had questions, but she was pretty cute. He liked that blonde hair, and it wasn't dyed. It was natural blonde. And you know what? Against everybody's advice and recommendation, nobody felt good about it. He married her. And I remember the day I heard about the divorce. She couldn't get untied from Mama's apron strings. The minute they were married, she hauled him back to, well, I won't tell you where, to another state. He never did make it into the ministry. Finally, they got a divorce, two precious children. He just had to have her. He's paid a price for it. Learn to wait on God. God's got a plan for you, young person. God's got a mate for you. And you know, your elders will feel good about it too. You know that? You feel a call to the ministry. The church will feel good about your call. God's got a way of putting his approval on the right thing. If you'll not get in a rush, if you'll just wait, let God work out the details, you can be a blessed person. You can have a happy, fruitful, productive life. But you start ramrodding your way through, and it's got to be your way. The problem is you can't see around the next curve in life's road. God can. God can tell you what the pitfalls are. God knows what those danger areas are. And so here's a man, Balaam, determined to do his own thing. He can still think of the money. You know the story. I'm going to bring this thing to a close. He gets down there and meets Balak. Balak starts building the altars, you know, and Balaam goes up trying to curse the people of God. He thinks because he warned him ahead of time, I can only say what God lets me say, he's still wanting to do what he wants to do. He still wants that money. The tragic lesson is he played with fire and he got burnt. Let me show you the end of his life. In chapter 24, after he tries four different times to curse Israel, and all that comes out are these beautiful blessings. Finally, Balak comes to him and says, look, he said, I paid you. Look at verse 11, 24:11. Now, therefore, now flee to thy place. This is the guy who was going to make him wealthy. I thought to promote thee to great honor, but no, the Lord hath kept thee back from honor. And Balak said unto Balak, spake I not also to thy messengers? And I told you if Balak would give me his house, I cannot go beyond the commandment of the Lord. I had to say what God told me. And now, behold, I go to my people. Okay, he said, I'm leaving. But he says, before I go, come therefore, and I will advertise to thee what this people should do to thy people in the latter days. And again, he gives another very beautiful prophecy. Verse 17, this is a lovely prophecy. Behold, I see him, not now. I shall behold him, but not nigh. There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. And he says some beautiful things down through there. And finally, it says in verse 25, and he arose and went and returned to his place, and Balak went also his way. Do you know what he got out of this? Now Jesus says, what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? With all these promises of wealth and fame that were going to come his way, you know what he got out of it? Nothing. He packs up and goes home, a man who has betrayed his convictions. He's gone what he knew God didn't want him to do. That must have been a long, lonely road back up to the river when he got back up home. And somewhere along the way, he got the idea, there's still a way out of this thing. And so apparently, he tells Balak, he said, there is a way you can get to Israel, and it'll be through the men. Said, you get some of your best-looking women to get out there and start enticing those men. And they did. And God brought a curse on Israel because of what was going on. In the end, 24,000 people died. Revelation 2:14 says that Balak taught the Moabitish women how to seduce Israel. And in chapter 31:8, let's see the last picture of Balaam. Chapter 31, verse 8. And he talks about they warred against the Midianites. And in verse 8, I'm in 31:8, and they slew the kings of Midian beside the rest of them that were slain. And he gives a long list of people, five kings of Midian. And it says, Balaam also, the son of Beor, they slew with a sword. He dies. Somebody murdered him. No money, no fame in Israel. You don't find him in chapter 11 of Hebrews. Everybody who comments on him says something negative. The man who could have been a real blessing for God is all hung up in his love of money. What shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? What is your price tonight? I'm finished now. What is your price tonight? I've said to people, if Satan himself were to walk into this tabernacle and start down through there and head for your pew, and he'd hold out some big sum of money, $1 million for your soul here, you'd look at him and say, no, my life's worth more. My soul's worth more than $1 million. Not interested, Satan. Go peddle your paper somewhere else. And yet the old prophet Isaiah comes a little closer to the truth when he says this to Israel. For thus saith the Lord, he says, ye have sold yourselves for naught. You wouldn't sell out for $1 million and then you turn around and sell out for zero. That's what you get when you do business with Satan. He's got all these promises, Grass is always greener on the other side. That's where all the fun is. That's where all the fame is. That's where all the money is. And let me tell you, friend, that's where all the heartache and that's where all the disaster is. I've never yet talked to an old saint of God, but what they said, I'd do it all over again the same way. Most of them say the only thing is I'd have started earlier. But I'll tell you what, I've talked to hundreds who said, I wish I could do it over again. Now, they're living with the consequences. What is your soul worth? What does it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Shall we stand together? I'd like our sister to just come to the instrument. Let's bow our heads. Just let God talk to us. Not a strong evangelistic message at all, but it may be that God has talked to somebody during the message. I'd like you to just bow your heads. Close your eyes. We do that to make it easy in case somebody wants to come to the altar. Satan says, oh, they'll see you. Let's make it easy for them. If there's anybody at all in this tabernacle this evening, you have some kind of a need. Satan's been making a pitch for you. Maybe you've given in some measure. God has been faithful and shown you the area of your way this evening. You need to come to the altar and pray before we go tonight. Not a long altar call, just an opportunity for you, friend, if you have a need.
Thank you for listening to Convention Pulpit, a ministry of Interchurch Holiness Convention, featuring Wesleyan voices past and present. For more sermons or for more information, visit www.ihconvention.com. This ministry is made possible through the financial support of our listeners. Keep passing it on. Keep passing it on.